now to refocus us and send us off on Primed for Action, David Frimmer will talk to us. He has, as Stephen Allen, in a more hidden way. Stephen Allen has been more hidden, but David Frimmer has been in dialogue with Barb once Barb conceived of this idea right from the outset and said, sure, I'll pencil you and I'll come. He has been part, of course, of, as I mentioned, of the Office of Lutheran Public Policy for quite a while. He has his BA, his MA, his doctorate from Princeton Seminary. He's been a parish pastor in New Hamburg and Kingston, I think, campus chaplain in Dalhousie, you know, and of course then has been in this office, has now moved on to being, we would call it the president, but other people would call it the principal and dean, I think that's the Waterloo language now, of the Waterloo Seminary. And in my comments in congratulating David on that, I said, well, at least we have one seminary where you can't have seminarians coming out which split faith from public life issues as healthcare or other social justice issues that we have in our life together. So I'm very happy that David has agreed to be here to close our conference for us.
I'm delighted to be here. I want to congratulate you. I think this is these kind of events are important, and it's important. When Barb told me and others that they were thinking of organizing, it is important to organize across the country. We've done this a number of times before, one of which was when the Canadian Council of Churches Governing Board met here. We had a major forum in Edmonton where the minister the Minister of Health showed up for that to speak to us about health care. When the Romanoke Commission was going across the country and hearing briefs, there was workshops in Alberta, I can't remember all the centers, where people actually wrote and made submissions. So this event stands in that tradition. And so those of you who are here, and I know there's some comments about it's got to happen again, you know, we should do this every year. I mean, in some sense, this isn't a continuation of events that have gone on before. I'm going to say two contradictory things now, one of which... when I heard Premier Klein talking about the third way, it sounds a little sinister, actually, or sort of sci-fi, as my daughters tell me. But it's kind of interesting. The first thing that came to mind was, I think it was Yogi Berra who said, you know, if you don't know where you're going, all roads look the same. The third way strikes me as, if you don't know where you're going, it looks like the third way. You know? On the other side of the ledger, though, in a more serious vein, I think people do know where we're going with health care. I do think there are people, and I'm not a conspiratorial kind of person, but there are people who do have an agenda for health care. Just like there was, do you remember gambling in this country when we started getting organized gambling? The first it was the kind of lotteries and then the casinos and the destination casinos, and this was the newest form of economic development. What that was about was about expanding market share for gambling companies. We shouldn't give them more respect than they deserve. The gambling industry in the United States had saturated the market there, and it was a way to expand market share. We're into some of the same dynamics in healthcare today, and there are companies, there are international actors who are interested in expanding their market share. And let's not kid ourselves. There is an agenda for some people. It's not an open slate. It's not merely getting together nice people having a dialogue about where we go with healthcare. There are some people who know, very clearly know, that they cannot take on the healthcare systems. Canadians will not stand for it. This is a national institution that symbolizes, as it was said again and again, who we are as people, that we don't have a national community unless we support one another. And they realize that this is something that Canadians won't stand for. And so in some sense, you have to have a crisis. You know, healthcare has to be in a crisis because then you got to fix it. And the way to fix it is to expand the role for the private sector, for profit, and who do you call on? You call on the people that they're already calling on to manage the hospitals, to help provide the services, to fund the P3s and do all those things. Now, I'm a nice guy generally speaking, although according to Stephen, I have my darker side too. So in one sense, I don't want to sound like I'm just going to say that all politicians are in to do a sin. That's not my point. But there is an agenda here. So in one sense, I want to make that point because it was surprising to me when I picked up the National Post. And by the way, I don't buy the National Post. I only read it when it's free. And that was a compromise. I used to not even take it when it was free, but then I figured that wasn't fair. You know, they're giving it to me. But it was very interesting to me that the province of Alberta paid $1.3 million for a three-day conference to learn something they could have learned by just handing out the Romano Commission report to all 450 people there with the event. I mean, these things, the National Forum on Health that Nuala Kenny was part of, you heard of, every committee, well, except the Mazankowski one, which is the one that the Alberta government wants to refer to, but all of them have gone over this material in a very thorough way. This is not new stuff. It reminded me of the pastor, you know, he became the new congregation the first time he got there, preached a sermon the first week, and people said, oh, that's a pretty good sermon. Preached the same sermon the second week, and people said, this is kind of a lot. Preached the same sermon the third week, and they said, geez, you know, I mean, and by the time he preached the fourth week, they were kind of, the chair of the council came and said, you know, look, I mean, 4 weeks in a row, you know, we sort of pay you to do something originally. He says, no, he says, I'm going to preach. He says, how long are you going to, the chair said to him, how long are you going to preach that? He said, I'm going to preach until you get it right. In a sense, this is what's going on here. People are preaching us in crisis, until we get it in our minds that, in fact, we need a for-profit, more for-profit involvement in our healthcare system. And in some sense, I think what's truly, truly remarkable is that, in fact, Canadians, after a tsunami of propaganda, right, that we need the private sector, still don't believe it. This is an amazing thing. I mean, it has some cause for hope. Let me just also say one thing I want to speak to briefly, and where I know we're Stephen's got a hook, so as soon as we reach 25 after, the hook comes and I disappear. But one of the things I want to say is, you know, we get despondent. We say we don't have an impact. Stephen addressed a bit of this in terms of our experience with the Romano Commission, right? You know, we plugged his health covenant, and Roy Romano, to his credit, he everywhere he goes now, he talks about what the churches did in terms of the covenant. In fact, Bishop Henry, it was in Saskatchewan, one of the bishops got on a plane, and Roy Romano was at the front, and he said to the steward, flight attendant now, he said, can you tell him to come? He comes up to the front, and he sat down next to him in the first class section or business or whatever it was, and he just went on and on how great the church's presentation was in terms of this health covenant idea. He thought it was wonderful. You know, so, I mean, that's one example. But we often think we don't have an impact. But just, we need to rehearse again, almost liturgically, that we have had a profound impact on this country. And let's not kid ourselves. There is an antipathy towards religion today, and some of it well-deserved. Religion has been a source of division. We've done some terrible things in this country in the name of our faith, and we should, in fact, own up to it and admit it. But we've also made a very, very substantial contribution, which public figures don't want to acknowledge. Let me just give you a few examples. South Africa, Namibia, do you remember those? Who put that issue on the agenda for the Canadian government? Who fought for years and years and years to bring an end to apartheid and to bring an end to the illegal occupation of Namibia, which was a little different issue because it had a League of Nations mandate and that it never fulfilled in terms of the South African government? Churches put that issue on the agenda. How many of you buy ethical mutual funds? Don't raise your hands. I know this is a personal privacy issue. But ethical mutual funds, corporate social responsibility. You've heard of it? It's not really oxymoronic. It is an important thing. Apparently, it's set to grow by 25%. That was what the Globe and Mail, I think, reported the other day. It is now 5% of the whole financial services industry in terms of retirement funds. Who started that? It started, you know where? Harthouse. When the churches brought together people who were interested in trying to do something different with investment. And part of it came out of South Africa when we realized that while we were condemning apartheid, we were benefiting in terms of our investments. Churches put that item on the agenda and made it an issue. Some of you were involved in the Jubilee, right? The Jubilee Initiative. 650,000 Canadians signed a petition saying they wanted debts canceled. The Canadian government has done some things way, way below what they should. Right. But in fact, Paul Martin, before he became the Prime Minister, couldn't tell everybody enough that it was in fact the churches and the Jubilee Initiative that put the debt issue on the G8 political agenda for the G8 nations. That's no small thing. I want to, the war in Iraq. Let me just end with that one. Or Section 35 of the Constitution, Aboriginal rights. You know that in that section we guarantee the rights of Aboriginal people are entrenched in the Canadian Constitution. Why? Because churches insisted that there be a Section 35 in the Constitution that provided for that, and it wasn't there. Now, the great tragedy is we haven't gone further. We haven't detailed what those rights are. We haven't gone far enough and fast enough in settling the land claims that are outstanding and that the people and that Aboriginal and First Nations people need to have resolved for their own well-being. But the churches were instrumental when no one else wanted to raise that issue. Where no one else were instrumental in that. The war in Iraq, and I'll just mention this one briefly. 35,000 people signed the online petition that the Project Plowthares and the Canadian churches put together to oppose the war in Iraq. My bishop, I might say with some sense of delight, was at the funeral for Cardinal Carter in Toronto. You may recall he died just around that time. And the Prime Minister, of course, and a number of dignitaries were there. And Prime Minister Chrétien said that that was a major influence in terms of Canada's position in not sending troops to support the war in Iraq. So if we don't think we're having an impact, let me just reassure you, it's not only that it may take a longer time horizon like Stephen and Greer have said, it's also that we sometimes have a kind of amnesia and forget that we are part of this national story and we have had an impact. Well, I'll go on all day at that and we'll never get out of here, and I think you'll all start falling asleep as things go on. But I want to say a little bit now about advocacy and where we go from here. That's what I was asked to speak about. And what you have here, my daughter had a book one time, Where in the World is Waldo? Have you seen that book? And they got big posters. I never could find Waldo, even when they had him colored in, you know. And just, I don't know. Anyway, this is kind of a Where in the World is Waldo. It's Where in the World are we? Because if you look at this, this is from the Federal Voluntary Sector Roundtable. It's the cover, the big graph, and it's dealing with how, who are the players in developing public policy, right? And if you look there, you can see how complicated it is. I mean, you can look on your chart, you probably can't read the fine print. There are hundreds of people, there are hundreds of forces and influence. This thing is kind of moving along like army ants, you know? I mean, it kind of, everything's sort of buzzing around. It is no longer simple. This is the thing we need to bear in mind. Nuella made that remark last night about the whole things of how all the competing interests. This gives you a kind of visual image of what that means. This is the kind of environment we are walking into. Now, it's not that we should be afraid of it. This isn't my point. We can carry, we can be involved in that, and we should enter it without being fearful. But we need to understand it. We need to understand that if we see the minister or we see a civil servant, there are all these other people that are part of this process too. And it's kind of like knowing who else is in the game. And I don't mean to trivialize it. The other thing about this picture that you'll notice, and you probably have a hard time with the version you have, is you don't see the churches there. Right? We're not there. There's no little church people or little bishop running around or moderator or something. We're not on that chart. Because a part of what I said earlier, the antipathy towards religion as being seen as a source of division in this country, we're not recognized. Now, that's not to say we haven't made a contribution, I just said. But it tells you, it says a lot about the people that write these kinds of things. Well, which leads me to a point, an important point I do want to make, and I'll try this thing too. Left click, right? 30 degree angle. Okay. When we go to see politicians, the first thing we have to understand is what do they expect of us? You know, now Stephen and I think others mentioned being prophetic and all those things, and that's all true. Those who know me though understand I'm a little suspect of churches. I don't believe in political committee or prophetic committees. I'm a little suspect on the prophetic dimensions of things. Sometimes people who take on the mantle of being prophetic aren't, and some who really aren't are. You know what I mean? We've all seen it. So all I'm, not that I'm against it, I'm just saying be a little modest in your role. We're not as prophetic as we sometimes think we are. But we do need to understand what the expectations are on the other side. And this comes from a study I did a few years ago. Where I went and I asked politicians what they expected the churches, and then developed a bit of a typology, that means different kind of things that they would expect. And I think it's important to understand that the first thing, if you ask all political parties, and this was done during the time of the Reform Party, or the Lions Party. Lions Party was still around. It's important to understand that, and if you get flack from people in your churches saying, why are we always involved in politics and talking about all these things, right? Just remember what one Alliance MP told us in this. This was a blind study, by the way, done by an independent interviewer who spent time with these people. But the line I remember what we had in the transcript was to the churches to say, if you're going to enjoy religious freedom in this country, you have a responsibility to make the political system work. If you're going to enjoy religious freedom, you have a responsibility to make the political system work. It's not good enough to say, you know, we're a religious community, we're not going to sully ourselves and get our hands dirty in this whole thing. Well, you have to. You have a responsibility to make it work. So one of the things we did is to try to figure out what different politicians expect of us. There's four here. I'm not going to go through the whole thing, and it may be a little tough to get your head around. But when I say these various, like liberals and conservatives and social democrats, these don't translate to the NDP, the conservatives, or the liberal parties per se. Okay, they're more perspectives. So a conservative perspective. When you meet conservative politicians, what they expect from the church to be is moral custodians, holders of the value, the social glue, so to kind of keep people online or in line with the kind of basic foundational things of the country. So you'll see this on the marriage debate, for example, for sure, that the religious community is looked to be the moral custodian. That's the role. Liberals, on the other hand, they see the churches as good ideas. They don't really care about your theology. They don't really care about justice. I mean, they talk about social justice, and that's nice, but they really cut to the chase. And the chase is this. You know, you got a good idea for us. And when you go to all-party meetings, you'll see this happen. I mean, conservatives and liberal politicians, you know, well, we want to hear what you think we should do, you know, what your proposals are. And I mean, all of these, by the way, are legitimate. So don't misunderstand me as trying to diminish any one of them. We do need to be moral custodians. We do need to put forward good ideas. But predominantly, that's what they're looking for. So when you're relating to politicians, you can't understand why they don't want to talk to you about something. You know, there's a reason, maybe. This is maybe what they're looking for. Social Democrats, I mean, it doesn't matter what ideas you have. It doesn't even matter about your morality. Show up for the demo. Right? Be there with the placard. If you're wearing a clerical collar, it's all the better, you know? I mean, put your vestments on, march down the street. That's a big deal. But there's a sense, and it's, what is it? Who is it? Woody Allen or whoever said that showing up is 9/10 of it, you know? I mean, that's what this is about. And showing up is important. Right? And churches often don't show up. Let's be clear about this too. When they maybe should. You know, you cannot underestimate, or you cannot imagine what it means to people who are in difficult circumstances when you come to their space to be with them. I mean, I used to go out, when the teachers were on strike in Ontario, we did a service, you know, and had them come to a church, you know, they were getting pretty beat up by, Senior Harris there. And, what happened, it meant a lot to them. It didn't matter if we agreed with them or disagreed with them, but what meant was that you were there. The presence was really important. And you know that in your own life, too. The pastor doesn't show up in a major life moment in your life. That's a significant time missed. There's a significant moment for it. Communitarians are, the last thing here is about community building. You know, it's what's important is we need to build a community. So what I guess I'm saying is when we do advocacy with politicians, we have to understand it's not merely, Greer's right, it's not merely about just going and being critical. But it is about being provocative and speaking to what they need for us. You don't be passive with politicians. You have to be assertive, demanding, pushy even, right? Because that's the way the political culture works. In the church, it's meant to be you're more passive, right? And we need to understand that. I think in some ways the church cultures are a little too passive. Unity is really important in church. So we don't like having these raucous debates, you know, where the gloves come off and stuff. But in a political culture, you know, you want to have the debate. That's how you get the new ideas. If there's no debate, it's pretty dead. So, I think understanding expectations is the next, is an important part of that. Now let me see if I can do this. I may not get this, you get it? There we go. Bingo. The Ten Commandments for Advocacy, and I'll just sort of share some of these with you. These aren't, actually there's probably 50 commandments for advocacy, but anyway, we'll stay with 10. I think be faithful, first of all, is the one I would say is really important. What are the values you believe in? And I think Stephen's point, this is why we took on the covenant thing. Why we developed the covenant. By the way, the first draft was written here. I think there were three or four of you in Alberta that took the first draft written right here. And in fact, what it was a process of trying to articulate what our values were that should inform why we put in place a particular program, a particular system of healthcare. And what we wanted to do is reach a consensus and then be faithful to those values. And in one sense, you can't use religious language always in those public arenas. But on the other hand, you can bring to bear values that are important and reflect what's important to us. The other thing I would say, the second commandment for advocacy is interrupting the false assumptions. I mean, you know, after you get up close to some of these people that are in public life, you realize how very human they are, right? But there's all kinds of assumptions. Like, for example, one of the assumptions in our society is that the private sector is more efficient in everything, right? You know, whenever and in fact, after the Romano Commission came out, the Minister of Health in Ontario said, "You can't tell me that the government is more efficient than the private sector." Well, in fact, Romano challenged people. He said, "Show me the evidence. Show me the evidence that in fact delivery of healthcare service can be done more effectively more efficiently by the private sector." No one demonstrated that. No independent study demonstrated that. Not only that, studies in McMaster and even at Parkland Institute here said they're even more efficient. Why? One of the things in the terms of the McMaster study is that the mortality rates were higher as in for-profit hospitals in the United States than in not-for-profit hospitals. In the Parkland Institute study that was done here in Alberta, they found that when hospitals move from the not-for-profit to the private sector, the first thing that happened is the senior management spent 40% of their time worried about being taken over by another company or trying to take over somebody else. The most creative pool of leaders in the organization are now tied up 40% of their time as compared to less than 5% with some of these other kinds of issues before, are tied up with things that are not leading to imaginative alternatives for healthcare. So we need to interrupt the false thinking. I mean, in some ways, maybe this conference that Mr. Klein has put together, the minister was shocked by private health tales. So I think this is the line in the post. Maybe this it will interrupt some of their false assumptions about what the private sector delivery can accomplish. But it's important for us to point those out too. And to do that, we need to analyze. You need to be engaged in an ongoing process of analysis of what's happening out there. I mean, some of the suggestions we have about how to humanize care, how to, you know, with touch and parish nursing and all those things, we have to be very careful, because if you don't have a broader analysis, the very things that you do on one hand lead to create the injustices and problems that down the road. Let me give you an example. When I was in Milwaukee, the parish nurse program, very well received. I said this in our little group. Excellent program. But many of the parish nurses told me, as I visited the various sites, that one of the things that was happening is that the hospitals were using this as a kind of way of reaching out in some of these communities, especially the low-income communities in Milwaukee, and they dealt with it like a charity. But it was also a way of recruiting more clients for their hospitals, you know, in terms of their health care and HMO ancillary kinds of programs. And it was also the problem that many of the parish nurses saw was as a way of sort of absolving themselves for the fact that so many people didn't have access to health care because they didn't have the health insurance, right? This was a charitable way of providing these services. And they said, "We don't want to be part of that." But unless you're engaged in that kind of ongoing analysis, it can look rosy on one hand, and you can walk down a road that all of a sudden you find yourself in a cul-de-sac where you're going round and round and round and you're actually becoming part of the problem and not part of the solution. Who is hurt and who benefits are two of the things that you really need. We bring to this situation that are really important. Amplifying those voices of people that don't get hurt. And I think that's important. And we always need to ask who benefits. Now, I was driving in yesterday on the van. They brought me to the hotel, and the guy that was driving it, you know, was talking about privatization. It was kind of refreshing, actually, for me. And we were having this nice thing, and he says, yeah, and he says, you know, I forget which person, was it the premier or the minister, somebody, in fact, who's related to somebody else who's going to benefit from outsourcing and privatization, you know. Well, is that true? I don't know. But we need to ask those questions. Who are the beneficiaries here? So that this can be a transparent kind of process to people, and they can understand that those whom they elect, or those who administer, or those who serve in public office, are working in their best interest. And we need to do work around that. We also, on the other hand, need to raise the question of who's hurt by this. Because many times it sounds great, and you know, those of you who've worked on policy or in policy areas, sounds great, works tickety-boo, right? But the reality is, we didn't factor in this or that or something else, and some people get very hurt very much by what happens. I'll give you one of the things we did in Ontario just before Mike Harris's government came to power was we were trying to do with welfare reform, for example. And there were a lot of people, refugees mostly, who were falling between the cracks in terms of services. So we we were doing advocacy, and we were talking to different ministries, right? The community social services, health, Ministry of Health, there was a labor and education secretariat, and also I think it was the Attorney General around some sort of legal issues with welfare. And we began to realize these people didn't talk to each other. So what we did is we brought all of them together. There was 150 people. We hosted with the Minister of Citizenship a gathering which brought all these civil servants together to talk to one another about how refugees are falling between the cracks, mainly refugees and a few other people. I mean, and in fact, we're able to bring some people who talked about how they were hurt in the programs that the government was administering. And people said, gee, you know, we didn't know about this. The other thing I would say we need to always need to remember is to go public. In fact, of trying to not keep these things to ourselves. It doesn't hurt to make public statements. Speak up. You know, I mean, I remember one case when we were dealing with a company named Talisman out here. Our pension plan decided to divest itself of its shares in Talisman and sold them all off. But they never said anything about it, so they didn't have any impact. Right? I mean, nobody knew. In fact, the next convention, somebody said, well, what about those shares we own in Talisman? I said, oh, we sold those a year and a half ago. And somebody said, well, why didn't you say something? When we come out of events, we always have to understand, go public, speak up, releasing statements, releasing public letters, church leaders' letters, these are important things to do. Build coalitions. I think we need to connect with other organizations, and not just in a multi-faith way, but other groups, in fact, that are working on this thing. And I was saying to Greer and some others earlier, you have a unique opportunity here. You have service providers, you have churches and faith groups, and you have people now that you've identified through these kind of gatherings who are actually working in organizations, bringing those three groups together to, in fact, bring forward ideas and proposals and to advocate with government can be a very powerful presence. Don't expect perfection. You're not going to get all you want. In fact, it may take a long time. And recognize humanity. We can easily attack people, even people we disagree with. We need to be careful about that. I never was a big fan of Mike Harris's, and I think he was the feelings were mutual insofar as we bumped into each other on occasion. But you cannot dehumanize the person those people you're dealing with. Okay, what are some of the ways to deal with this? You've got some ideas there. I think it's important to engage the government. I'm not an educator. I like education, but you can't just educate for change alone. Sometimes you gotta confront people. You gotta show up in their office. You gotta enter a dialogue with them. And there's a number of ways to do that. Letters to government are important. If you decide to have a network, send a minister. Ask questions. Every letter you send to an MP, MLA, whatever, always include a question. Because then they gotta respond to you. Then they gotta write something back. Then they don't write you the form letter saying, thank you very much, blah, blah, blah. You've gotten those before, I'm sure. The other thing I'll give you is if you're going to work as a coalition, I got a couple more slides, but the one I want, this one looks pretty complicated. What this is, the big thing here is about, is called OODA, the OODA loop. I thought it was kind of a neat title. I'm not much in making these things up, but John Boyd is known for this. It's around strategic thinking. A friend of mine who does a lot of work in New York on advocacy. It's about when you're engaged in trying to put forward your views. Now you're involved in the advocacy, okay? You're going to go to the government. You got your 3 points, and I think Stephen was helpful in that. The thing you have to do is you've got to kind of, it has to be interactive. It can't be, well, we're going to go and launch our letter or our position, and that's the end of it. You have to observe what's going on. So what's happening out there in the public policy arena? You need to orient yourself. So all of a sudden the government announces whatever it is that they announce, and you say, geez, how's that, you got to ask, how's that fit in with what we're saying? Then you've got to decide, and then you've got to act again. And one of the things churches are notorious for doing is, you know, we'll get to it. We'll decide that at our next, I mean, you know, we'll put that off, we'll vote on it. Well, it has to go to presbytery, and then it goes to the, you know, the synod, or then it goes to the, by the time you get to it, it's old news. You know, so we need to have this very kind of interactive approach, and I won't belabor that a lot more. I think there are 3 things that you have the basis for in terms of building a kind of network and coalition that you can focus on. Values, and I would say one of the things you might want to think about is taking the covenant, as Stephen said, and really leaning on the provincial government. Go to Michael Swann and say, will your party endorse this as part of its platform? Go to the conservatives and ask them, will you adopt this? These are conservative values, aren't they? Go to the NDP in Alberta and say, will you support this? And can we have an all-party agreement in the Alberta legislature to support a health covenant that will guide health care reform here? Because it reflects a lot of the things you were saying, I think, in the covenant. The other thing, I think you have some new approaches around touch, parish nursing, all those things. Is the government prepared to enter into a public voluntary sector partnership with churches and faith groups to really move these things along and support the work that Greer and others in your communities are doing? And I think the thing, part of the thing would be to kind of continually press for a public system, no more expansion of private sector delivery, but to ensure there's a public health care system for all people. I think that's one thing we keep saying. Don't forget the other people, people that don't have it. These are things I think you can push for, and I think you have the basis for. Well, let me see if this works. Yeah, this is my last slide. This is the quitting time, but I love this quote from Augustine, where Augustine said, hope has 2 lovely daughters, anger and courage. Anger so that what must not be shall not be, and courage so that what must be shall be. You never give up on this stuff. You know, if you're involved in this stuff, it'll be frustrating for you. You'll be feeling like you're banging your head against the wall sometime. But I used to have this picture up on my wall for a long time, and I love it. But you know, can you see it? The frog is—he's 2/3 gone, but he's still hanging in there. And after 20 years of doing this, it's sometimes like I feel. But I know you'll feel those moments too. But I think it's really important. Don't give up. Keep going, because people are counting on you. To speak and to ensure that we are what we can be as a society and as a community, and we can certainly be a lot more than what we've been. Thanks very much.